Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on February 18th, 2020. This class is the fifth of our Tuesday evening 2020 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. This talk and our Sangha discussion is on the virtuous aspects of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So we're in week five. The first. How many of you read the article of this week's study?
I read the chapter.
The chapter, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. And I may not have. Did I just
buy the book from you?
Pardon me?
I have to buy the book. I went online, but I still have to catch up with the rest of you.
Did I explain that the book is on the website too, that you can read it there if you want?
Maybe you did, but I probably wasn't paying attention.
Okay. Well, anyway, there's this book called The Truth of Happiness. This study, this 12-week study, is based on that book. And we're in the fifth week right now. Each week, what we're doing is reading that particular chapter. And then doing a little writing on it, a paragraph or two, just so we understand it as best as we can, and then we talk about it. And that's what the discussion part of it is. So. Great. And so last Saturday I read, I think we're about 45% through this chapter, and I read and talked about that on Saturday. Right view and right intention. That we looked at a week ago. Initial right view is simply the view that I am ignorant of Four Noble Truths, of true human reality as described as Four Noble Truths. And because of that ignorance of Four Noble Truths, I fabricate a self in relation to the world that, because of the fabrication itself, rooted in ignorance, is prone to craving after continued self-establishment, rooted in fabricated views, and clinging to those views once established, no matter what those views are. So I ask this a lot. Is that clear to everyone there, what I just said?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because that's the beginning of stress and suffering. And so the solution to stress and suffering that this brilliant man figured out is applied directly there. And it's related to where we are right now in that Eightfold Path. So right view is initially the entry point. I'm accepting that I don't know something, and here is a way to understand that. And I also understand, and we went into this pretty extensively on Saturday, how strong an intention to maintain a fabricated ego self is, and what is necessary to recognize and abandon that powerful but subtle need, reactive need, for a fabricated self to continually maintain itself in the world. And that leads us to the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, so-called. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. I call them virtuous factors because they are. They're rooted in virtue, meaning I speak kindly and gently. I act in the same way, and my livelihood follows. But the reason why these are significant to the Dhamma is not just because we'll be good people. It is because when we become mindful of our thoughts, our words, our deeds, and the way those deeds manifest at times in what we do for a living, that is where I notice the results of my thinking. In other words, if my thinking is rooted in ignorance, it's going to manifest itself in the words that I use, the actions that I take, and at times in what I do to make a living. And also I should mention that right livelihood does not just pertain to what we do for a living. It's really, what am I doing to establish myself in the world is a more broader way of looking at that aspect of right livelihood. And that encompasses that, and it brings right intention into that, doesn't it? So when we are mindful of what's coming out of our mouth, we are mindful of our thoughts, because it's our thoughts that are driving what's coming out of our mouth, isn't it? I mean, we first have to have a thought in order for anything to come out of my mouth. And if what's coming out of my mouth is less than ideal as defined by right speech, then I know that there's something lacking within me. There's some point of understanding in relation to Four Noble Truths that I'm missing, or I wouldn't be thinking, speaking, or acting in any way that's hostile towards myself or towards anyone. And then another, and I'll talk more about this too, another just as significant aspect of right speech, and maybe more so, is the speech that I'm telling myself, that story that I always have going in my head. And it's that story that's always going on in my head that is, the purpose of that story is to continually reinforce wrong views. And that's why right speech, right action, right livelihood are such a significant aspect of the Dhamma in showing us the results of our thinking. Is that clear to everyone? Okay. And it just what I just said about a thought always precedes anything that comes out of my mouth. I mean, that's kind of obvious. But any action that a human being takes is, it has to be preceded by a thought. Even something that might be like a reflex action, there's still a thought underneath it. But the best example that I can give of that is when I leave tonight, in order for me to walk out the door, I don't just get up and walk out the door, do I? I first have a thought. Well, class is over. It was a great class. Time to go home. There's a thought behind everything that we do. And the reason why I'm making an emphasis of this point is the thought behind what we're doing in this moment determines what my experience of this moment is going to be. And if my thought is framed by the Eightfold Path, this is a teaching on karma too that I'll get into deeper in week 7 or 8. If what I'm holding in mind is framed by the Eightfold Path, then this moment is a moment that is inclined towards awakening, towards putting aside all of those things that are rooted in wrong view and wrong intention. And in this moment, how do I know what the state of my thinking or my consciousness is? By being mindful of what's coming out of my mouth and the actions that I'm taking. And it's always that. This isn't right speech, right action, right livelihood aren't preliminary steps, although they're usually the initial foray into an Eightfold Path. But they're relevant throughout the development of the path and beyond. It's just a natural expression of an awakened human being. Does everybody have that clear too? The reason why I'm saying that is as we start developing the Dhamma, then we can rely on aspects of right speech, action, and livelihood to reinforce the Dhamma within ourselves. Another reason why we don't have completely silent retreats is because it negates the value of practicing right speech. In other words, right speech informs noble silence. There cannot be noble silence, using that word noble. There cannot be true noble silence without the focus on right speech, because then it's just forced silence. It's agreed upon silence, but there's no insight gained into why am I being silent. The reason why I'm being silent in this moment is because I don't have anything that fits within right speech. We experience that on retreat because of the framework that we establish on retreat. And then we develop noble silence because we then agreed to take our meals in noble silence. But the rest of the time on retreat, those that have been on retreat, how many times do I ask you, how's your right speech going? Mm-hmm. And at least a dozen times, because that's the point. If we were engaged in a 4 days of complete silence, there's no opportunity for right speech, is there? And again, it's something the Buddha never taught, noble silence without right speech. In fact, there's a Dhammapada section where he said, it's not by silence alone that the wise become awakened. A little bit of a paraphrase, but it's true. We have to be mindful of our speech if we want to be mindful of what we're thinking and how we're acting. All right, this is back to the article. Frank, I don't know the page. It's about 40-some-odd%. And the beginning is from the perspective of right view, which is right where I left off on Saturday. Did you find it?
No. I'll catch up. Thank you.
Let me see what the paragraph before is. Right speech also pertains to what we are saying to ourselves. Right. Got it?
125.
Okay. Everybody got that? 125, if you're reading along. From the perspective of right view and the direction of right intention, right speech develops to very subtle levels. Once gross wrong speech is identified and mindfully abandoned, recognition of speech that may have seemed helpful and altruistic may now be seen to be manipulative and designed to elicit a particular response. A lot of altruistic behavior, seemingly altruistic behavior, falls into just that category. We're really saying something in order to elicit a response from someone. Even if we think that the response is helpful to the person, it's still manipulating. It's still not getting to the reason why there's an there's an external situation is not because someone else doesn't know right speech. It's because someone else is rooting in ignorance. So the proper response isn't a Band-Aid. The proper response is using yourself as an example. And that doesn't mean every time you come across someone else engaged in wrong speech, you got to slam them with a Dhamma. But it's never helpful to counter wrong speech with your own wrong speech. Never. It only leads to it. And this gets into very, very subtle levels of how we live in the world today. And I won't get too deep into it. But a lot of this, if you want to get a good view of it, just look at the politics in this country. And the only reason I bring it up is it's such a perfect example of ongoing wrong speech that people believe is right speech. Just look what's coming out of both sides' mouth. They're both guilty of wrong speech. Being mindful of words expressed towards others will show the state of your well-being and understanding. In other words, if we're always kind in our thoughts, words, and our deeds to other people, always, and most importantly to ourselves, we are starting to integrate the Eightfold Path the way it's intended. And when we notice the very occasional situations where I find myself speaking in anger or lying or gossiping, another aspect of lying would be exaggerating something, could be something pertains to me or a situation, I know that there's something wrong in my thinking. And oftentimes we'll blame the world or another person for our wrong speech. You know, Flip Wilson had that great line, "The devil made me do it." But we, you know, most people don't know who Flip Wilson, right? Some people do. That's the excuse that we blame other people when we do something that we wish we hadn't done. And we put it on other people, we put it on situations, we put it on a lack of not analyzing myself when I was 7 years old and something terrible happened. All of that is just a distraction. If I'm engaging in wrong speech, action, or livelihood in any way in this moment, it's because my mind is still rooted in ignorance. That's all that I want to know about it. I don't want to know, well, it might be coming from this, or there's a social situation that kind of precludes complete right speech. It's all nonsense. It's all nonsense if we are true Dhamma practitioners. That doesn't mean that we don't marry wisdom with our right speech. And then that leads to noble silence. We know when something isn't helpful. And so in this moment, there could be something that is obviously helpful to Mary for her to know, and it would greatly enhance her life. But I also know the situation well enough that Mary is not going to accept what I say. So what should I do? It's the great conundrum, isn't it, of the person, the great person filled with compassion and wants to help another person. But I know it won't help. I know that she'll either at best disregard it and more than likely get upset over it. The wise person keeps their mouth shut. That's noble silence. That's noble silence. Because it has rights, it has the intention for right speech behind it. Some people would argue it was right speech to say, you know, Mary, you're really failing at this. And if you just did it this way, you'd be a better person. Because I'm just trying to help. Well, you're not trying to help, are you? Look at that. And this is an important point. Look at that situation. My intention was to help Mary. But the judgment that Mary needed help is the problem, isn't it? Instead of understanding that Mary's problem and everybody else's problem, according to what the Buddha awakened to, is ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So how best can I help Mary in this situation? I'm just picking on Mary, by the way.
Oh, helpful. Sure.
If I feel that she's open to understanding any bit of the Dhamma, it's okay to talk about it. More than likely, those situations aren't going to be apparent. And the best thing that I can do is to be an example of the Dhamma. To not be threatening to someone who's not ready to let go of something. Look at the difficulties we've created in the world by individuals and then groups thinking they have the right idea, they have the right way to live in the world, and other people have to follow me. And if they don't, that can often lead to justifiable homicide. The modern jihadists have that all down, but in past times, a lot of Christians had it down too. And there's, and I'm just picking on Christians, there's no religion that has escaped that notion that my God is right, I'm right, and other people should die because of it. But that's where that notion comes from, that I know what's better for you. We wiped out an entire culture that has yet to rebound. with that idea. I'm talking about Hawaii. It's yet to come back. Before we went to, I'm getting on my high horse, I'll do it quickly. Before we ever went to Hawaii, the Hawaiians, the Polynesians, had a worldwide economy. They had found ways to resolve difficulties within themselves, even though they were still a warring society. And we come in and we see nothing but savages that we're going to save them. And we didn't, did we? But we do that all the time. And we do it with individuals. We do it on a global scale. And we haven't learned anything from it. It's not like we're evolving past something like this idea that I know what's right for you. And if you don't follow me, you're evil. Again, look at politics today. But look at how we interact with each other. And again, I'm not talking about this Sangha. But a lot of our difficulties in the world come from me wanting the world or other people in the world to be different. It's the essence of the Dhamma to understand that's my problem, not others, not the world's problem. Anytime that I want something to be different than it is, I'm engaged in wrong view and wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. Anytime.
It's really strange, though, how right now the politics is very negative and counterintuitive to what Michelle Obama said. You know, when they go low, we go high. What works is when one group goes low and the other group goes lower. That's when people respond to that. It's very, very bizarre.
It is, but that was somebody, I can't remember who it was, said that's what we should do as part of their party. Mm-hmm. You know, when they go low, we'll go lower. It was Eric Holt, I remember who it was. Mm-hmm. And this is, so just to use that as an example, not to beat the guy up, this is an intelligent man. Mm-hmm. A former attorney general.
Right, but he was observing what actually happens, not what the way we should conduct ourselves.
Well, I took the statement as saying that's what we should do, but I also understand what you're saying. But that's the reaction, isn't it? That's the reaction of a mind rooted in ignorance. You hurt me. The only response then is I got to hurt you back. Yeah. And that's where we're at. Again, I'm not blaming Democrats, I'm not blaming Republicans, I'm not blaming the United States. This is the common human condition. It just happens to be manifest right now because of certain situations that came together. You know, a perfect storm back in 2016. And again, all of it is an example of our ignorance. All of it, every bit of it. And you can't point to one person and say, well, they're right because they're more aligned with my ideology. Hatred is hatred. Anywhere. It's never appropriate. Again, I don't mean to be getting on my high horse. I'm not speaking against one side or another. I'm speaking in the whole world. Hatred at any point is wrong. It's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And it never leads to. This is hatred is another word for it. A milder term is aversion. We know that greed, aversion, and deluded thinking are the result of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Aversion or hatred, even though if we seem to justify it, is still rooted in ignorance, isn't it? Frank, you had a question or comment?
I was just going to mention that for myself, my speech has gotten better internally and externally from right view and understanding, right intention. And it's more of a fruition than an objective. It's not that I'm trying with speech.
Yeah.
It's more of that's what comes to fruition when I can abandon craving and clinging. I can be kind. Because being kind and non-cruelty is actually less cruel to myself.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it releases the pain and suffering a lot quicker than reacting with wrong speech or continuing anger and ill will.
Yep. And you're right. It's the result of a well-focused Dhamma practice. It's not in this moment, it's important to recognize, am I engaged in right speech, etc.? But ongoing right speech, action, and livelihood is rooted in the Dhamma. It's not rooted in a reflective action. It's a responsive action. It becomes part of me. There was a time in my life when I initially sobered up, I was 26 years old. And I remember in AA, you're given somebody who's called a sponsor. They're supposed to guide you through. It doesn't work anymore, but they guide you through 12 steps. And my sponsor was doing this. He was taking me through this process of self-reflection, which is what the 12 steps are meant to be. And we got to this point where you're taking an inventory. You're telling this person about yourself. And I remember I was in tears because I was just so upset. If you're a real drug addict and alcoholic, you tend to lie a lot and you get caught up in it. And I remember saying to Bob, I was so full of lies, I did not know. Honestly, I did not know when I was telling the truth anymore. And I remember crying to Bob saying, I honestly don't know what the truth is. And this was 1981. And I still remember everything that he said. He's right in front of me right now. He says, if you want to be honest, be honest. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was the right thing to say and incredibly obvious. But for the first time in my life, I understood that if I wanted to be a different person, it was possible, but I had to change some behaviors. And that initial four-way probably led me to where I am today because it gave me the license to look at myself in a realistic way rather than trying to find something that was wrong with me. In other words, Bob didn't say, boy, you're the biggest piece of garbage because look at all you do is lie. He took right where it was. If you want to be an honest person, be honest. If we want to engage in right speech and right action and right livelihood, we simply do it. And when we can't, that's where we bring the Dhamma in. It doesn't mean that if I find myself lying tomorrow and I recognize it, it doesn't mean that I've done something wrong and I'm a bad Dhamma practitioner. In fact, I'm practicing the Dhamma exactly as it should be. In that moment, I recognize wrong speech. I take a breath and I enter and remain, as we'll hear the Buddha say, enter and remain into right speech. Go on a little bit more. Being mindful of self-talk will deepen understanding of craving and clinging and further establishment of your ego self. And that's how jhana meditation works, and that's why it works so well. It's why it's the only meditation the Buddha taught. Because in meditation, as I find that I'm caught up in my thinking, what I'm really recognizing is being caught up in continued eye-making. And that simple and powerful act of taking a breath when I find that I'm caught up in my thoughts, bring my mind back into my body by using the breath, I'm interrupting the ongoing flow of continued ignorant thinking. A direct and practical benefit in jhana meditation that is lost when we practice anything else. Any other type of meditation, I'd say. Be mindful of the Buddha's words. Be mindful of wrong speech and enter and remain in right speech. That's what my sponsor said, basically, essentially the same thing. If you want to stop lying, stop lying. If you want to be in right speech, enter, remain in right speech. There's no mystery about what right speech is there? Everybody knows what it is. It's not complicated at all. Right action and right livelihood follow the same moral and ethical guidelines of right speech. Right action is abstaining from taking life, remaining harmless to all beings. Abstaining from taking what is not freely given, taking only what is offered. Abstaining from sexual misconduct, acting with generosity and kindness. Abstaining from selfish acts, acting for the good of all. The Buddha's words, be mindful of wrong action and enter, remain in right action. And right livelihood follows the same. Abstaining from dishonesty, profiting from virtuous acts. In other words, we've gotten to the point in this country where there's a whole faction of people that think making money is evil, it's wrong, it's bad, especially people that make a lot of money because they must be doing something wrong to make that big pile of money. Well, for one thing, that's getting into people's minds. It's mind reading, isn't it? And even if it's true, what do I care about it? I'm not going to lose my mind over it, am I? But even the Buddha says it's okay to profit from virtuous acts. And what is a virtuous act in business? It's providing a good product or service. That's all it is. There's no big mystery about any of this, right? Livelihood, it's doing a good job. And it's also taking a profit. As long as it's virtuous acts. Abstaining from hurtful endeavors. Contributing to the common good. Abstaining from the sale of intoxicants. Abstaining from the sale of weapons or harmful items. And this has to be all taken with some understanding too. There, the Buddha, and I'm not teaching that we should ban all all arms, all guns and rifles and shotguns, et cetera. That's ridiculous to think like that. It just is. There's a lot of reasons why. But there is entire populations of people that if they couldn't get a hold of a gun, they'd starve to death. It's mostly in northern climates, but there's pockets of people like deep in remote areas that if they couldn't take a gun and kill an animal, they'd starve to death. And yet there's people that say that shooting the gun is wrong and killing an animal is wrong. Well, I'm very glad that I've gotten to the point where I don't have to make those moral judgments on anybody, including myself. It's just obvious what's going on out there. And again, to make these blanket statements against something is hatred, isn't it? Or aversion. Right livelihood is remaining harmless when earning a living while contributing to the common good. Can anybody argue with that? That is right livelihood? Mm-hmm. Remaining harmless while earning a living and contributing to the common good. And what happens if I come across someone who's earning a living by not contributing to the common good? What should I do about that? Take a breath. And I mean, I might decide as an individual that I'm not going to buy that person's widgets, but that's an individual thing. If I take that to the next level, and because a self-referential ego self is only feels comfortable when a lot of people think the same way, then I'm going to start getting on my high horse and talking about that awful widgets that person sells, and nobody should buy those widgets because look at what an awful person he is, and look at all the people that get hurt, and look at this, and look at the oppression, and the whole world sucks. We should blow the whole damn thing up because of that guy's widgets. But that's what we do. Instead of not losing my mind, taking a breath and maybe not buying the widget.
And you never really know someone else's story.
You can't. That's such a good point. It's never appropriate, even when you know someone's story, it's never appropriate to judge someone harshly. Why? Frank said it, because it hurts me, and it hurts all of society. If we really want to, if we really care about other human beings, and I think most human beings, unless they have a deep pathology, do care about others. The problem is we don't know how to go about it. If we really care about other people and all the things that we still think are awful today, the oppression and et cetera, we know the most effective thing we can do is take to the Dhamma and awaken and be an example to others. Because anything else is just continued aversion and continued agitation because of my aversion to something. To put another label on, it's the most unawakened thing anybody can do. Even though a lot of people do those things thinking that word woke. I just heard that. Like maybe 6 months ago. That's been around a while. Because I notice that every person that seems to use it is the most unawoken person I've ever seen. And it's mostly because of this, because of what we're just talking about. They're claiming that they're woke because they're against something. And that's the criteria for being awakened. If that's the criteria for being awakened, Siddhartha Gautama would have died without anybody ever hearing about him, because it's ridiculous. It doesn't resolve anything, does it?
It will pass.
Yes. The Buddha's words, be mindful of wrong livelihood and enter and remain in right livelihood. So that's what the Buddha said about how to develop these virtuous aspects. We all know what right speech is, right action is, and right livelihood. When we are involved in the unskillful or the wrong aspects, what do? We recognize it and enter and remain into what we know is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. My words, it requires great wisdom, coupled with compassion, to know when to speak and take action, and when to practice wise restraint. When the Buddha referred to himself prior to his awakening, he always referred to himself as an unawakened bodhisattva. And I won't get into the nonsense of taking that vow, even though I did and renounced it. What the Buddha is saying is that I was a human being, filled with incredible compassion for all other human beings. Yet as an unawoken, a bodhisattva means caring for all human beings. As an unawoke human being, I was lacking the wisdom of how to practice my compassion. And it's interesting when you read the Siddhartha Gautama story, he didn't do anything to try and help other people. I'm sure he opened a chariot door for someone that needed it. What I'm talking about, he doesn't take up any causes until he awakened and was truly woke. And then he tried to help other people awaken. He didn't do this nonsense today that it's called engaged Buddhism, which is really what that, a reaction, and it's preying on an individual's aversion. Compassion without wisdom can often be hurtful. It is often less than skillful to speak or act solely to make others feel better about themselves or to further validate others' wrong views. Throughout the Pali Canon, the Buddha presented this example of restraint of speech when speaking would only reinforce someone's wrong views. As virtue is developed and understanding of the importance of bringing wisdom to compassionate thoughts, words, and deeds develops in the Ratana Sutta, the discourse on the three jewels. The Buddha and his attending monks first addressed the physical and emotional needs of a town that had been devastated by natural occurrences and disease. They then presented the Dhamma in a way that would have meaning. And we're going to touch on the Ratana Sutta. I think it's our last class, maybe. The Ratana Sutta also informs that Dhamma practice is not effective as an isolated event, practicing only on our cushions or special occasions or special situations. In order to develop virtue, concentration, and wisdom, Dhamma practice is engaged in mindfully, moment by moment. Moment by mindful moment is my words there. By maintaining mindfulness of our thoughts, words, and deeds without defense, deep insight into conditioned thinking arises. This is the practical mindfulness and insight that is necessary in order to abandon all aspects of the distraction of stress and awakening. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood are grounded in right view and right intention and are supported by right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. That's the end of the chapter. And so we're going to see next week how the virtuous factors are supported by the concentration factors. I'm going to have to get a knee on one of these. And those concentration factors support being mindful of right speech, right action, right livelihood, don't they? As we deepen our concentration, we're able to hold in mind what's coming out of our mouth. We're able to see it. Our minds aren't going so fast towards the next thought, the next reactive thought, to actually see what I'm thinking. Such a wonderful experience, isn't it? To start gaining or regaining control of your thinking. Because that's really what this all is. It takes us right back to right view. Even in many suttas, the Vitakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha says we gain the ability to think what we want to think, when we want to think it. Imagine that. Think about a situation where someone's in your face and screaming at you. And even then, you can say and think what you want to think when you want to think it. Why? Because you're not entangled in the world. You're not taking your cues from other people about how you think and how you should feel. You've really gained. There's a sutta on independence. Lost the connection. You really are gaining true independence. Lost everything. It's the coolest Akaka Sutta, I think it's called. It's a fearless and independent Dhamma. The Buddha teaches, it's not that the Dhamma is independent. The Dhamma leads us to individual understanding of our own independence. Constant freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom from worldly entanglements. It's not freedom from the inherent stress and suffering that's part of having a human life. We're still born. We'll still get sick along the way. We'll age and eventually we'll die. Along the way, we'll get things that we were striving for, grasping after, but we'll also lose things and we'll receive things that we'd rather not have, like old age or failing eyesight or legs or whatever it might be. Or traffic, noisy people, angry people, lousy politicians, this and that. It's just part of life. And we learn not to take any of it personally. When I can stop taking things personally, that means I've abandoned all clinging to those things. It's the definition of freedom and independence, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yep.
When we really understand the Buddha's Dhamma, nothing defines us. Nothing. Because we don't have any preconceived ideas that we're using to define ourselves in relation to the world. Our minds are fresh in each moment. Okay, that's enough for today. Let me start in the back. We still got some time, but I know you guys got to leave at 8:30. Eric, how you doing tonight?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thanks for asking.
Good to be here. Yeah, I would say that in dealing with other people on a daily basis, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, you can really notice it. What you were saying earlier with the unawoke people. It helps me practice it better. In dealing with other people, it brings it to the forefront of my mind.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric. I did ask a question. When did we start using this term woke? I'm just curious. It's been a little while.
Oh yeah,
five woke, years. Couple
really?
Years. 3 years.
Okay. Woke. I'm glad I'm disentangled. Hello, Frank. How are you?
Good to be here. Good to see everybody. Yeah, I agree with what Eric just said. It's in engaging with other people, especially at work, where a large part of your life is lived at work, and. I happen to have a job where I have to engage with 30 people that work there every day. And they bring, human beings bring with them their stuff that's happening in their life. And I used to be that person too. And there never seemed to be space when engaged in a conversation with somebody, especially when they are taking things personal and projecting very personal, personally in the conversation.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I've been able to be a part of the conversation, listen to the what's underneath all of the feelings and emotions, and get to the core of the issue and understand what they're trying to tell me before they even say it, just from the way they're acting and the way, without being entangled in it, or feeling that heart racing. Mm-hmm.
You have to fix it.
Yeah, or I have to fix anything, and I just, I don't know, there's space in there now where I can, and I think it aggravates some people sometimes.
Okay.
Where they're expecting a reaction from me, and I'm not.
Yep.
And I'm methodically just thinking and talking, and I can almost see them looking at me saying, why are you not getting angry?
Yeah. Especially if that's how you used to be, because it's expected, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Possible.
Yeah.
But that's all I have.
Thank you, Frank. Yeah, I mean, that's an aspect of ever deepening mindfulness of what's occurring in this present moment. We find mindfulness. And there's people that still attribute Siddhartha Gautama with having clairvoyance and magical powers. He never claimed that he could, but part of it was because the way he interacted with people, it seemed at times he was reading people's minds, but he wasn't. He was just simply present with them. And so you understand people when you can actually be present with them without your mind being stuck somewhere and their mind being stuck somewhere. And there's two people conversing and you're not even there.
It kind of is reading their mind, because their mind is coming out through their body language and their words. Yeah. And they don't even really have to speak many words.
Yep.
You can kind of see what's on their mind.
It is, but there's nothing special about it. It's just a well-concentrated mind. Any mind that is well-concentrated is able to do that. And it's off-putting. It can be off-putting at times, especially when you come to grips with, or you're getting used to it is a better word, because there's still a conditioned reflex at times when you see something in someone and you know that it's just what I was talking about, Mary. You know that there's a better way, but you also understand in this moment that this person isn't ready to hear it. Mm-hmm. Take a breath. That's all. Just because I think something would help someone doesn't mean that I have to. And that's a compulsion, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That I have to say something. And my excuse would often be, because I'm trying to help. Well, it's not. There's no help in that, is there?
I've tested those waters before.
Yeah.
I think we all have.
Yeah. It almost always leads to some kind of stress or suffering. So. Thank you, Frank. Hello, Liz.
Hi, John. It's good to be here with everybody. I picked up two things that I really liked in this chapter. One was the, and this is based on my philosophy of everything folding back into itself, where you had said, right speech, right action, and right livelihood are grounded in right view and right intention and are supported by right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So it's like everything just supports everything else and folds back into it, and that's such a nice concept. The other thing is this idea of, I'm going to butcher the word, but Kalyanamitta.
Kalyanamitta.
It's the idea of spiritual friendship, but in particular, from what I read, the concept that I liked in particular with this idea of a spiritual friendship is what is your own self-talk?
Yeah.
So your spiritual, almost like your spiritual friendship with yourself. Yeah. Although that sounds kind of quaint, but what is your own understanding? What is your state of well-being and understanding? So I like those two ideas, and I do feel like I'm making a better connection with checking in with myself frequently, saying, what is the condition of my mind? What is the condition of my mind? I'll find myself getting frustrated or impatient, usually.
You said something about that self-talk, like being mindful of self-talk actually deepens your understanding of right view.
Yeah. Oh, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's our inner self-reflective thoughts that are maintaining ignorance. In other words, the getting upset with someone and carrying that argument with me for a couple of days, that's a gross example of it. But the much more subtle aspects is the conversation I'm having that's maintaining that situation in my mind for days on end. In other words, I'm still thinking about how much I hate the guy for what he said to me 3 days ago. The person isn't here anymore, is there? That person is gone and on with their life from 3 days ago. In this moment, I'm maintaining that through the thoughts that I'm having about it.
And a couple of arrows in your side.
And a couple of arrows in my side. So that's that aspect of self-talk that maintains stress and suffering, maintains dukkha, maintains ignorance. And Liz is so right that when you start integrating that, you are practicing the Dhamma. That's it. Liz, when you first started coming here, if I said to you, the Dhamma is going to resolve in I can't remember exactly how you said it, in the thoughts you're thinking about, I'm going to mess it up anyway. Would you have thought that the Dhamma resolved within your thoughts in this moment?
The Dhamma resolved what? The Dhamma resolved?
In this moment. And it resolves in the thoughts that I'm holding in this moment.
Yeah. What I would also say is, and this is kind of how I think sometimes, but, you know, it's like, how much time do any of us really believe we have left in this world? And if you have the opportunity to think what you want to think when you want to think it, why would you spend time?
Why not?
Mulling the negative thoughts when you could be sitting thinking about, for me, thinking about how I'm going to make something or resolve a problem within that, or, you know, thinking more expansive about my work, or, you know, or even just thinking more expansively about the Dhamma. You know, the amount of time that I personally have spent in negative self-thought, now you can look at it and say that it's not very productive.
Yeah. You can see it. Thank you.
I'll be quiet. I thought that understanding everything and reading it and studying it was going to do something for me. And it wasn't until I realized I had to do something, like right intention and right action, and the fruition of right speech by doing right intention.
Yep. You actually had to do some things.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between what the Buddha taught and everything else that was taught at his time and this. The religion is not about doing something. I mean, there's rituals and stuff. But you're saved by osmosis, by being a true believer. The Buddha didn't teach anything. He didn't teach you to believe in him. He taught you to take refuge in him, meaning their safety and understanding a human being did this, and he taught us how to do it. We're not taking anything on faith or on belief or conjecture at all. And it resolves where we are. And what are we as human beings? Well, we talk, we act, we do things for a living. The Dhamma, think about that. The Buddha developed a Dhamma. He developed a person-centric Dhamma as opposed to a non-person-centric Dhamma, meaning a speculative, fabricated result of whatever your practice might be. He, over and over again, he says the resolution of the Dhamma is within each individual. And you notice it by your speech, your action, and your livelihood. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. So this is my favorite aspect of the Dhamma when we study the Eightfold Path. Because if we want to feel different, we have to behave different.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times, we were talking about this last week, insight's not enough. There are a lot of people who have an awful lot of insight, but it doesn't alter or change how I might behave differently. And I think when you all came back from the last song, your retreat, I don't know if it was the last one or the one before, it doesn't matter, but it was about the right speech and the right in applying it to yourself internally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in conceiving about how to stop that negative self-talk, like where I work, you get all these evaluations and you can read 23 really good ones. And then there's a fourth one, the 24th one that's terrible. And, ultimately it's that one that sticks to your shoe, and you carry it around with you. So this idea of the fabricated speech or right speech inside yourself for yourself, and to being gentle and kind, and if I'm expected to speak to you politely and respectfully, then why am I less so? And that really helps with, hard I've been on myself over my many years. So it's just, I love this part. It's very practicable. Is that a word?
Yeah. It is now.
Practically.
Thank you, Bonnie. Kevin, how are you?
Nice to see everybody. Nice to be back here. I just was thinking about the self-talk part and sort of this that we talk about the negative self-talk, but then it's like, we have to fix this and have this positive self-talk. It's just that I notice the self-talk doesn't arise as much any longer. It's there, and you're thinking this one way, but it's not like I'm like, now I have to think about, palm trees and green flashes because I like Hawaii. But it's there. It's coming back to the sensation of breathing, and it dissipates, and then it's just living your life as life occurs. Whether the person's cutting you off in the traffic, or you're dealing with people at work or your family. So I've just noticed it quieting less frequently. We thought that was worth clarifying because we don't want to just be endlessly distracting ourselves with positive self-talk, which is another fabrication.
It is.
So that's not Dhamma, just to, everything's flipping around and great. So it's like noticing that place in between there, I think, is what we do here.
Yeah, that is. Thank you. Yeah, but positive self-talk is just as debilitating as negative. It's the same thing. It's still maintaining a fabrication. But you described developing the Dhamma as the Buddha describes. As you develop the Dhamma, your mind becomes quieter. Or sometimes the word is calm, but it's the same thing, isn't it? And it's important to recognize it. You see it in yourself. I see it in all of you. And that, it when you think about the turmoil that a mind is in that's rooted in ignorance, just to be able to recognize a little bit of quiet and calm is just remarkable to me. Anyway, David, good to see you tonight.
I think once you realize the emptiness of the aggregates, that when you do exhibit behaviors and speech, that there's only one appropriate action is to take to the Dhamma and to develop the Eightfold Path. Mm. And it just rolls back to that. And as you deepen your understanding and development, then you do have that quietness. And I think Ram said it a while ago, that it just becomes what you are. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Wonderful. Andrew, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Good to see you.
A few moments ago, you said that positive self-talk can be as detrimental as negative self-talk.
Yeah.
Could you talk to that a little bit more?
Sure.
Understanding that.
As a counter to my own negative self-talk and sometimes what might be put on me from the world, parents, siblings, friends, just situations, most of us start seeing ourselves not as completely perfect, something lacking. And often the counter of that is to apply the positive Band-Aid to that. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard to see these things. They're very, very subtle and very powerful. That's why I call them that. And so as a counter really to the way I think about myself, I'll then add another layer to that. Well, I'm not that bad because I think someday I'm going to play center field for the Yankees. I use that a lot. Or I got really nice eyes or whatever it might be. Or I'm the world's greatest. Those are all compensation for what's underlying the belief that there's something wrong with me. There's something lacking in me. And so all that it does, it's an obvious distraction. And it just perpetuates the underlying feeling. It doesn't do anything to change it, does it? In the moment, I might feel good. I might have resolved an issue in my mind from going from a negative view of myself to now buying into, I'm not that bad. I'm a pretty wonderful guy. And that doesn't mean we should wallow around thinking we're awful either. It does mean we should see ourselves realistically, which is without any good or bad. I said a couple of weeks ago, and I said it a few times, I don't see any good in the world anymore. And I don't see any bad. That's where freedom and independence comes from. And in my own mind. And the other thing that comes from that is as we integrate the Eightfold Path, especially these parts, right speech, action, and livelihood, we no longer have to be looking over our own shoulders for what's coming out of our mouth and what our actions are. Are we acting correctly? Am I being a good person? It just comes natural, like Frank was saying. So did I answer your question?
Yes. Can I add something to that?
Please.
There's actually been studies done that show that people that practice a lot of this kind of positive thinking are, in fact, unhappier than the people that don't.
Yeah. Look what they're focused on. They're focused on escaping their unhappiness by insisting that they're happy or positive, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot of that around. Much of modern Buddhism and modern religions are about substituting a fabricated ideology for what you think of yourself now. Usually it's put off in the future. But all of that is simply to compensate for a wrong view of self. And when we let go of the wrong view of self, it changes everything as we experience here. Tim, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. If you can indulge me for a minute. Sure. Usually it only take 30 seconds, but... This Eightfold Path discussion over the last 3 weeks has really brought together the entire Dhamma. in my view.
Good. It should.
So just indulge me if you could, so I can get through it real quick.
Take your time.
I've noticed that with the virtuous factors, there is a tendency of there's consequence. Consequence to our speech, our actions, and our livelihood within society. And the Buddha has mentioned many times through this is the practicing restraint on all the virtuous factors. There's always restraint involved. And, well, the old cliche of thinking before you speak, thinking before you act, those things. Everyone seems to be talking about self-talk, but isn't that just being mindful of your thoughts? Well, look at the four factors of mindfulness. Isn't self-talk just a thought that you're having, and being mindful of your thoughts would be mindful of your self-talk? Yes.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so
that it's predominant is what's important.
Right. So, I kind of thought that during this discussion that talk is really a thought. So, I'd like to just read what I and expand upon a little bit what I read on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
After reading everything over the last 3 weeks, and that it was this, that right mindfulness, and specifically the concentration factors, right mindfulness, allows us to apply right view, the wisdom factors, to integrate the virtue factors in an appropriate way in accordance of the Dhamma, understanding and knowing what is right speech, action, and livelihood, and release from any passion and reaction to any external or internal impermanent phenomena through dispassion to end all worldly entanglements and detaching from the ego. So this, through wisdom born from refined mindfulness, will allow the virtuous response or no response to any given situation. So when someone's screaming at me, upset, a client, family member, or somebody just distraught, I will be able, through that process, to be able to respond in the right way.
That's the idea. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, then that might be even a more significant question. If you don't, what should you do then?
Well, go back to the breath and use, or, you know, be mindful of the quality of your mind, mindful of your thoughts, and mindful of your feelings.
Yeah, but that's beautiful, Tim. That is, I mean, you could say that the Dhamma is there, so when you get into your next argument, you don't.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not taking things personally. But it seems so significant and almost insignificant, almost too small to even talk about. Why is he talking about an argument that I might have? It's just an example, but it is at those very subtle levels that it's important to recognize that Dhamma's working here. Because on gross levels, we can incorporate anything and decide anything. But when it gets down to that, that's where the rubber's hitting the road.
But,
see you, Frank. See you, Eric.
Oh,
good to see you guys. See you next week.
One last thing. This all rests in dispassion, really,
yep.
Because even in politics or anything in society, it's the dispassion allows us to not react through a self-referential view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And
stay in reality.
We really can all see that on a day-to-day basis. And I don't want to take any more time, but I that's been an incredibly helpful, practicing the Dhamma in this way has been incredibly helpful with my own anxiety, which is dissipating by the day. And through my relationships, because the ego is not there to be bruised.
Mm-hmm. You have reaped the benefits of your continued right effort. This is just how it should be. You're describing the Dhamma working as it was intended, and as a result of your right effort. Thank you for sharing that with all of us. That's how it is. Kate, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to be back.
Yeah.
So speaking of the Dhamma working, over the last 2 weeks when I wasn't feeling well, I noticed it working in my life a little bit. So historically, when I wouldn't have been feeling well, I would not only be physically ill, but I would shovel mental garbage on top of that, like guilt, can't take care of my child the way I want, frustration, can't go to work, anger, I don't want to be feeling this way. And I just noticed that this time, your line about don't add a condition on top of a condition just kept playing over and over in my mind. And I just thought, okay, I'm just going to be sick. And it made being sick not as bad. Like, it eliminated the
second era.
Yeah, that's right.
The mental garbage that comes with it sometimes for me. And so, yeah, it was just an example of how I sort of saw my thinking and my self-talk sort of change a little bit where, yeah, I didn't feel like I was sticking with second era anymore.
Thank you, Kay. What a great example, of the Dhamma working. It didn't... There was no miracle cure to your flu, but you didn't make it worse by needing it to be any different. That's such a good example, it explains something that people don't understand. Many people think that the Buddhism is a way of ending all suffering. It's not, is it? The Buddha never claimed that. It's a way of understanding suffering, and because you can understand it, in this moment I got the flu, I understand that. I don't take it personal. And so all I have is a flu.
Right. Not a mental condition.
Yeah, that's right. And that's, again, that's what I mean. Kate didn't lose her mind. But it's an apt description to say she would have lost her mind if she started judging herself harshly for having the flu. Right? I mean, that's a mindless thing to do.
Is that not wanting life to be different than what it is at this moment?
Yep. Yeah. And it's not saying nobody wants to have the flu, but when you have it, it's good to just have it.
But it's also just, if I can interject, it's also the nuance of the particular kind of mindfulness that this is about. It's not just being mindfully aware of what's happening in your environment or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's being mindful of the Eightfold Path, which is a different kind of generalized mindfulness. It's a very nuanced and specific kind of mindfulness.
Yes.
That you were able to recognize what it was that made you feel worse and be able to then turn it around so that it didn't become the second arrow.
Yes.
Which is just a wonderful point in all of this. I think we've all felt that, even if it was just for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, that you can catch something. It gives you that opportunity to make things different.
Yeah, that's why I refer to it as refined mindfulness. The Buddha didn't teach this generalized, you got to be mindful of everything that's going on. He taught to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path in this present moment. That's quite different, isn't it? And that results in what Kate just described. It was, as sick as you were, having the flu is awful. You still were able to maintain a calm and peaceful mind.
Yeah, I felt like I didn't lose my mind as much.
Yeah.
Usually I feel mentally bad to match my physical state because I do. I feel guilty. I feel frustrated. Like I don't want to stop my life for a week. But this time I was like, well, what am I going to do? This is what's happening.
Good for you, Kate.
Matt is the first one who said to me, just because you don't want something to be happening doesn't mean it isn't happening.
Yep.
I was like,
that's right.
Right. But like, I never thought about it that way before. So now I kind of think, I don't know, I saw myself approaching it that way.
Well, that's what it, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you
for sharing it with us. Hello, Rom.
Yeah, it takes a huge amount of suffering out of it.
It takes almost all of it.
You can almost watch it. You know, you can watch the progress of what's going on. You think, oh, okay, here come the sniffles. And all right, here comes this, and then we get that, and pretty soon I'll be having that. And in a way, it's just, yeah, that's how it is.
Yep.
So you take care of yourself, and there you go.
That's it. And so you're not enjoying having the flu, but being present with it has its own type of poignancy.
Yeah.
You're
not hating it. Just makes
yeah,
it huge.
It's just it's what the Buddha said. You're gonna have it if you have a human life. You're probably going to get the flu every now and then, and this and that. Other things are going to happen. It's just part of having a human life. And Kate nailed it. There's nothing personal about it. In fact, you could say the only thing that's personal is being alive.
Yeah.
It's the only thing we should take personal.
So as far as what I got out of this chapter, and again, I look back at my first encounter with the virtuous factors, and I saw that they gave me a measure of ease in the beginning, because I could stop doing this constant judging whether what I was doing was right. All I had to do was just follow these few simple rules. And there was a huge amount of ease that came from that. But then when I got further into it, I realized, oh, it's not always easy. And at that point, they really started working, because then I realized what kind of ego view I had invested in that decision to not follow those easy rules.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's right intention.
Yep.
Came right in there and showed me that my intention still wasn't quite right. And look at that and see where it should be, and the ease came back.
Yeah. That's a good point too. When we're really struggling with our Dhamma practice,
mm-hmm.
when it's not easy and gentle, it's because we're either missing something, missing some understanding, or we're judging the heart, ourselves, and the Dhamma harshly. You know, come back again. The same. The answer is come back to your breath, come to class, and practice that refined mindfulness that we have. Mary, good to see you. Thank you, Ram.
Good to be here. I think everybody has said it. I think that when you are witness to the baggage falling away, when you're witness to what is happening but also what is not happening,
yeah.
And you experience the space of joy or the absence of dis-ease that's occurring, it's in itself, you know, rewarding enough to continue and to try to do the things that continue to bring those factors out, and try, and which is, you know, right speech, right intention, right view, to ensure that, you know, tomorrow repeats again, and it's another pleasant day and pleasant outcomes, etc. So it's almost like there's no turning back once you have an experience like Kate did. She'll probably never be sick any other way than what she just experienced, because it's so rewarding and seems so like, wow, that seems pretty logical. So I think there's so many indications, again, that you're doing it right or you're on the path. It's not something, you know, it's something to be experienced for yourself,
uh-huh.
a hapasika. And it validates and confirms all along the way when you are and are not, you know, in the right view or whatever the case. So anyway, I appreciate it every day in my life, and I experience it every day in my life when I'm, you know, when I have the right effort in place. So thank you.
Lorna, how are you tonight?
Good, thank you. Very quick story to tell, that I went out for a walk in Echo Hill Park, which is near my home, in the woods with a little lake there. I can walk out of my house. I don't need the car or anything. I can walk there and then walk around the park, which is something I do quite frequently. And then I stopped and looked at the lake, and I just sort of caught my thoughts. I realized that I've been walking around the park and not seen anything and not heard anything. I hadn't smelt anything. I was just lost in my own thoughts. Mm-hmm. Just constantly.
Like you weren't even there.
Like I wasn't even there. And I'd been walking for about 45 minutes from my home to do that. And it was actually just looking in the water. I decided to kind of look at the water. And that was the first time I sort of really looked at something since I left the home that was not in my imagination. It was because it was water. And so that sort of, when I looked in the water, I realized that I hadn't had any sort of pleasure of the wood, of the woods that, you know, the pleasure that the wood would offer me. I hadn't had any. I had no smells, no sound, no, you know. Anyway.
And what happened then?
I thought, doggone it. I'm useless at this.
And?
No, I didn't. I just realized that here we go again. I've fallen for it again, fallen for my own fabrications, but enjoyed them like I do.
And?
And then come back to your breath and be a bit more mindful of dropping your own internal thoughts and just trying to be more present with what is happening. Yeah. Anyway.
Thank you.
Life goes on.
Yeah, another example of the dominant. I mean, it doesn't matter if it was 45 minutes, 45 days, 45 seconds. You practice the Dhamma. You realize you were caught up in your thoughts, came back to your breath. Mm-hmm. It's Dhamma practice. And the important, the significant thing isn't the 45 minutes. It's coming back to your breath. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. I've really benefited from everybody's talk tonight. And I don't think I have anything more to add. Just something that Lorna said made me think of a line in a song that Russ just wrote. He wrote this song that's, I call it I just said it wrong. Anatta song. And it's a song about this guy who thinks he's hot stuff and is pretty sure he's right. And then this woman comes and kind of knocks him off the rails and says, you know, smash all your mirrors, eat some humble pie. And he said, there's this other line in it that I'm referring to that says something like, I don't always come in first, but I never come in last. At least that's the story I tell myself. And I do like to listen to myself. So this whole song is about how this guy then turns around and realizes the shallowness of his thoughts. It's hysterical. So I'll send it to you if you want.
No. When next time Russ is here, he's singing it for us.
I could actually play it on my phone, but it's a 3-minute song.
No, Russ has to do it.
No, all right, you got to ask.
I will.
The guitar.
So anyway, Lorna always says something that triggers something that I can connect to. So that was it tonight.
Thank you. Anna, how are you?
Great.
What do you think about tonight's class? And how was your, you were here Saturday. How was your meditation practice since then?
I wish you guys could speak Korean.
maybe we could understand the sentiment.
Right. been about a year ago, I broke half of my face and had 60 stitches. And I had a hard time looking at myself in the mirror or smile, because I didn't, the crookedness of my smile, I always thought it looked skewed. And I catch myself ever since Saturday smiling. And I'm looking at myself in the mirror, and I look. And the funny thing is, it's almost as the little Korean girl that I left behind Korea when I came to this country comes back, and she smiles back at me. And your explanation of the noble silence, I always thought silence meant death. But yeah. I am not scared of losing or welcoming any kind of hellos or goodbyes. I'm just grateful. And I feel, maybe I'm menopausal, I feel my whole body's, where every nerve endings feel tingly and lighter, even though my doctor, yes, they told me I gained 4 pounds. I feel all the stacks of index cards, whether it was in English, Chinese, or Japanese, or Korean, I felt like I had a huge bonfire, and I don't feel I don't need to use them in different scenes and different people, because I feel like the English saying, it is what it is, and I always hated it because I always thought that was like such a lazy way of people saying it, because without defining what it is. But I kind of understand, and now it's becoming my favorite saying, because it makes sense. You don't have to define it. You just have to be whatever it is. And just grateful for all the experience, whether it's good or bad. It doesn't define who you are. Yeah. If that means anything.
It means everything. Thank you for all, and for your honesty, and for being a part of our sangha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just have to catch up with all you. I feel like I'm in a master class, and I'm like, there, like this, you know, water girl.
There's only learning the Dhamma. There's no such. Yes. There's no advanced stages to this.
Yes.
And so everyone here, including me, started right where you are. That's how the Dhamma is, and that's one of the reasons why we keep a pure Dhamma here. Because we know that it works as long as people engage in right effort like you're doing.
Dhamma is not a sport.
So continue to be very gentle with yourself.
Yeah, said it allows us to meet each other where we are.
You're meeting yourself.
Right.
And in a very real way, it's not your situation is unique. It's actually the most common experience in the Dhamma is we finally gain an understanding of who we actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And who we actually are, when we understand that, is always calm and at peace, always. It's only because of wrong thinking that we get this me agitated and distracted.
Right.
And so it's all up to us. Continue to be gentle with yourself. Continue with the Dhamma practice, and you're gonna do fine. You can see that you have the inclination, the intention to do it. Be gentle with yourself. What a great class. There's no class on Saturday. We'll be up on our teacher's retreat, so we'll pick it up again next Tuesday. So you'll read the 6 weeks chapter on the concentration factors, do a little writing on it, and we'll talk about that next week. And I keep thinking there's something else that I wanted to say, but I'll put it in a newsletter. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.